Blog Talk Radio. good evening, and welcome to another edition of The Bachelor Pad. It's L.A. Bachelor. It is The Bachelor Pad Show. We thank you for joining us. 646-929-0130 is the complete number to get in touch with us. And we certainly thank you for joining us this evening wherever you are. You could be doing anything else, and we certainly appreciate you being a part of this broadcast. Coming up, we will talk a little later. We'll talk with Christopher Brooke. He is the legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union, also known as the ACLU. I'm going to talk some legal discussions with him. This person occupying the White House wanting to build a wall and use emergency funding or use the Emergency Act. Already lawsuits coming out, whether it be California, whether it be the ACLU, whether it be Congress. There is some definite people who are not happy with this. And that's what looks like is going to happen in terms of the bigger picture. So there's a fight coming. And this president was certainly one of those that is looking to enact some things that have taken place in the past. And we'll talk about that. You know, other presidents have enacted the this act that, you know, was put in place back in 1975 and put in place in 1976, or I should say implemented in 1976. So, you know, that's where it is right now. We'll talk with Christopher Brooke, of course, as I mentioned. He is the legal director there. I want to go to the phones and bring in my first guest. Of course, he's a media personality, motivational speaker, of course, a community activist. He is Dr. Lee Bell. And Doc, are you there?
Yes, L.A., I am.
Good to talk with you, sir, and I appreciate your patience. Before I get to a couple of the topics we had discussed off air, your thoughts on the president trying to enact this emergency funding, taken away from not just the DOD, but other places to get his $8 billion that he wants to build this wall that's going to keep us all safe and you know, all is well. And I'm being sarcastic, of course.
Well, it's a crime in and of itself. In his oath of office, he swore to uphold the Constitution. And it's up to the Congress to decide where the monies will be spent. It's a power grab. It's unconscionable. Most of the country do not want a wall, a monument to him. Most of the country wants border security. The statistics say there are better ways to secure our southern border than by building a brick and mortar wall. There's modern technology, there's the good old human touch, and some other new era ways that we can help shore up our borders. And it behooves me that the people who are fighting 45 with this wall, to me, all they need to do is play Ronald Reagan's mantra, tear down the wall. Once again, It's okay for America to advance its wishes on other nations, But it's a different story when it comes to us. Congress has allotted it.
And it seems to be very racist, Doc, I would think. You know, the fact that, you know, he wants to build this wall to keep, you know, essentially right now, if you look at the countries of Nicaragua and Honduras and stuff, brown people. But he's also been very vocal and malicious when it comes to black people in African countries and calling them, you know, in their huts and call them everything there. So all of this is just that hate mongering, that fear mongering that he's doing in order to build this wall to please the base that has those feelings in itself.
Yes, and LA, if you go to the north, you can just walk right across the border. But what hue are those who are at our north? Why do we only need a southern border? And I think you touched on that.
Yeah, our Canadian friends up there are, they tend, let's just say, and not all, but they tend to look like him and not like us. And, you know, but it's going to be some kind of fight. As these days and weeks and months and even a year goes by, we'll talk about that with Christopher Brooke. I wanted to get your thoughts, though, speaking of which, on a social injustice that someone has put forth that is coming to some form of conclusion, and we'll see if he is a quarterback on the team. This is Colin Kaepernick. The NFL and Mark Geragos, his lawyer and others have announced that they reached an agreement to settle this rather than going, you know, continuing in court and trial and everything else. They've agreed to settlement. That there's no disclosure of what it was. What's important to you with this, Doc Bell, as you're a community, not just organizer, but activist, but you're socially conscious that if he settled, and it comes out that he settled for some small punitive amount, what does that mean as opposed to a big amount? In other words, if he took the NFL to the cleaners, then that speaks to me bigger volumes than if he decided to take something small. And if there is some clause or some provision in there, we're saying, okay, we'll give you this, and we'll let you back in the league. Now, they can't say that to him verbally, but there are some ways you could dance around it, because if they did, obviously they will put themselves on the hook for collusion, which would be another court case, so they can't say, hey, we blocked you, but they blocked him anyway. So what would you take out of this based on what hopefully we will find out in this settlement?
LA, if I read Mr. Kaepernick well, I don't think he settled for peanuts, and I'm praying he didn't. I believe he stood on his principles. And this is a case that would allow that to happen, because the NFL, they don't want the onion peeled back. That was the beauty of Colin Kaepernick taking this to the next level. The NFL has so many bones buried, so many skeletons, that Colin Kaepernick had a hand to play the game with. So the NFL decided to settle rather than have some of those skeletons exposed. And I'm believing with my whole heart, Kaepernick and company settled for what he and they believe are in the best interest of what he stood for in the first place, calling the attention to some of these scams in society, such as police brutality in our communities. And it's a partial victory, and I say it's a partial victory because his lawyer, Mark Garrigo, says he believes within 2 weeks or so that Colin will be on a team. It can be a complete victory when he's on a team and actually is given a chance to play. Keeping in mind, he has lost 2 valuable years of his playing career. Now, Mr. Garrigo says that Colin is in excellent shape still. So I pray that he's given the opportunity to get back on the field and do what he does best.
But why is that a half victory, as you call it, if he does get to play? Why is that not a full victory, in your opinion?
No, I'm saying with the settlement alone, that's a partial victory. It will be a full victory when he gets to play again. And not just put on a team and sit on the bench, but so that he has an opportunity to actively compete for a starting job. And if there's no starting job available, that he is put in the position so that starter isn't able to carry the team, that he can step in immediately.
What precedent? It's got to be, to me, it's a little quirky, Doc, because, you know, if he settled and they allow him, and I say allow him, back into the league, and he's unscathed, if you will, unscathed meaning that he's back in the league, then is the NFL opening themselves up to someone else being a Kaepernick, or, you know, and there's some social change or social issues that they want to bring up? Do you think he signs some kind of disclosure saying he won't speak out if he plays? I mean, there's still some variables here and some pieces that we just don't know.
Without a doubt, there are some variables, but I do not believe he would sell out. He's put too much on the line to sell out, I believe. I believe he's a man of his word, a man of his conviction. And I don't think he would come back to play the game just to play the game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one would hope that that's the case. We're talking with Dr. Lee Bell here on the Bachelor Pad. 646-929-0130, the number to get on the line with us. Doc, I want to switch gears to the hot mess in Virginia. And again, as dynamic and complicated in some cases, the Kaepernick settlement and what we don't know behind closed doors and whatever was decided on, I'm sure we will, is even more perplexing and you know, strange in how things are going down. First of all, the basic question to you, and we've had black folks, white folks, and others, not just on this broadcast, but all over, have an opinion on Governor Northam, and should he step down? What do you think? Should he step down?
I think for the best interest of Virginia and the country, he should step down, L.A. I'm still bothered by a lot that has gone on with this case. I do not think he has learned a lesson, if I can put it that way. There's too many unanswered questions for me in this. One big question for me is, the governor said that's not him in the picture. Okay, if it's not you, who is it? Who took the picture? The governor says he could be a better leader because of this incident or incidents, and I have to disagree with that. I think if he were truly remorseful for what he did, and when I say what he did, he admitted to being dressed as Michael Jackson in blackface. If you listen to that news conference, he was very condescending to his wife. He couldn't remember something, and she prodded him to remember. That's why you're here. And if you're wearing blackface to honor Michael Jackson, you have the glove, you have the shoes, the hat, but you can't remember Michael Jackson's name? That's the problem. I think the governor, if he is truly remorseful, step down from your governorship and walk the walk. He's a white politician in America. Give up the office. Start all over again. If you have to run for dog catcher and work your way up, let your work speak for itself as you recline the ladder. I think that's the route he should take.
Yeah, and you get that. What's very disrespectful to me, Doc, is that, you know, just like when we talk about race in America, we had this conversation, oh my God, when you became the professor and you were teaching these kids and teaching people on race, that it's hard for me to see him lead the conversation on race if you dressed up in blackface, number one. And anybody, Anderson Cooper talking about race relations at a town hall meeting, and he don't look nothing like us, and he might have one, you know, he might be gay and might be discriminated against him in that way, but he can never preach on color, right, and that kind of thing. And I just threw him out there. I'm not picking on Anderson Cooper. I'm just saying. But the other part of it is, too, Doc, you know, how do you remember dressing up in blackface for Michael Jackson, which I don't understand unless you're doing Thriller. It still doesn't make any sense. But having said that, you remember that. But earlier in the same year, you don't remember dressing up blackface or Klansman or whatever the case may be. And then the third part of this, Doc, to get your thought on it. You know, how are you, like you said, who took the picture? It's your yearbook, and how do you not know what happened in your yearbook? And then part of that also is, you know, the blackface is demeaning. The Klan thing is terrorizing. And I had to explain that to someone on the air that is of a Caucasian persuasion, that you don't understand. You can't just say he just forgive him and keep it moving. You, if you're associated with or you dressed up like that, that is a sign of domestic terror. And they don't get that. They don't understand that what the Klan stands for in the history of this country. And so I'm with you. I don't care, Democrat, whatever, and they trying to, and he might have some policies to help some black folks there in Virginia, and the Commonwealth is kind of crazy in itself. But I don't care. You gotta take a loss. They gotta take one for the team. He needs to step down if he wanna learn about race and be humble and all that stuff outside of the governorship. That's fine. But you don't need to be the governor while you learning on the job in race relations. That makes no sense to me, especially as a white person.
And the other piece of this, he is supposed to be a public servant. But he's defiant. I'm not stepping down.
Right. Which is that privilege and that supremacy, too, Doc. That's that privilege and that supremacy. Look, I'm sorry. I made a mistake. Can we just move on? All right. My bad. Can we just move on? No, we can't. We can't. And that's, I've had people on this show, Doc, that, you know, say, hey, well, you know, if he steps down and we'll get to the lieutenant governor thing and everything else, then the Democrats lose. What? I'm sorry. Then they just got to lose. Then let somebody, let the voters go vote. If they, if they're progressive and the way Virginia's going, then let them reelect somebody or elect somebody else. But you got to take one for the team on this one.
That's true leadership, L.A. You know, part of the process is having to explain to others, discuss with others what you've learned from this situation, what you would do differently as you're, if you choose to get back in the political game. Your actions have to show that you're walking the walk, not just talking the talk.
Right. Yeah. And that's really where it seems to be at this point. Talk with Dr. Lee Bell here on the pad in Flint, Michigan. We'll get to the water crisis, the updates there. Doc, what the lieutenant governor and what he's going through there in Virginia, black man, I just, you know, people always want to say you're crying race, but you have to cry it when it is there. And listen, and I said this on the air, and I'll continue to say it, and I'm saying it to you, Doc. If he is guilty of these things, right, he needs to be under the bus. Like, he needs to be under the jail. He needs to be he needs to be held accountable for what he's done. Having said that, they want to let the governor stay, who admitted blackface, let the attorney general, who admitted wearing blackface, but the guy in the middle who has not been officially charged or anything, they want him to step down. They want to impeach him, do this and everything. And this has come from black and white politicians there in Virginia and some of the presidential people asking him to step down. And it always seems to be that way. I'm not trying to turn this into purely, oh, he black, that's why they're trying to take him down. But I am trying to say there is some double standard and hypocrisy here. You have two white gentlemen who have admitted to doing wrong, and then there's a gentleman that might have done wrong, but we don't know officially yet. So talk about the double standard there and the fact that, you know, we can hold our own accountable. If you're real about it, if he's wrong, he's wrong. He did what he did. He should be held accountable. But at the same time, they ready to run him out of town and under the bus and under the jail and everything else. Meanwhile, the other two admitted it, and they're defiant, and they're not necessarily everyone calling for them to resign.
Well, L.A., as you said, it's a double standard. We have a person occupying the White House who has done all kinds of despicable things, but he still continues to hold the office. And I think that's the pattern that the Attorney General and the governor, I think they're riding that coattail. Now, for me, the lieutenant governor is a different animal, because this is possibly a case with legal ramifications. And with legal ramifications come some rights and some responsibilities. The lieutenant governor has said there was no ill will. Both relationships were consensual. He has offered up to go undergo the FBI scrutiny, if you will. I'm not even sure if that's applicable. But if we're talking legal, the FBI should do whatever it is they do, investigate, and sort of move on from there. With that, I feel wholeheartedly for the ladies. As you said, when it happens, tell. Because when you don't tell when it happens, you hurt your own case. I'd hate to see these women have to go through the litany of what's going to come, having to relive and having to retell what they experienced. Now, it seems to me that Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, if you look at this case, that he may be a serial offender.
Right.
Now, if he is a serial offender, I'm sure he didn't just stop with two indiscretions. So if there's some additional women that can say truthfully that he offended them, that he assaulted them, they need to come forward being accused of sexual assault. It's not a minimal accusation.
Right. I have to say this. First of all, I'm speaking for myself, and you don't have to agree, but Pat Nation, I'm speaking for myself. First of all, no means no, people, right? I might have done some things in my life, but no means no, number one. Number two, from all of what I understand and research, and I'm saying it like that because I'm a man, right? So victims won't come forward because they have guilt and shame, and maybe they did something wrong and things of that nature. And that's just horrifying. I can't imagine going through something like that, knowing that you were violated, and you just don't come forward based on the feeling that you have of guilt or embarrassment or no justice or whatever of these victims go through. And they're victims. They are victims. So I guess, Doc, before I go to Reggie, I guess my question to you, and we can only put it in a context of what we know, because we're not women, but shouldn't it be some form of, my concern is some form of balance in the age of Me Too, where there has to be, and I said this on the air last week, there has to be some form of, Doc, some form of due process for those being accused as well. So the victims are there, and the victims, you know, are who they are. And if these things, like I said, these things happen, these people need to be prosecuted. But it's really weird because, of course, in Northam's case and then Judge Kavanaugh's case, well, you know, do you want to ruin a guy's life or whatever? They don't say about the black folks, but the black men, but that's a whole different topic. But my point is that aren't we going down sort of a slippery slope if someone comes out and say this happened and we all automatically brand somebody without going through the due process? Because in some cases, like in the case of the victim in that he went to school with in Duke, she asked for him to resign. She talked about what he did and forcing and raping her. But she made a point in her letter, her press conference, what she wrote, that she wants him to resign. And some people look at that as political. I'm not saying that I do, but I'm just saying they look at it, okay, well, maybe she's got an agenda. But my point is, again, just some long-winded, Doc, is that don't we need to find a balance somewhere with this? Because we have to be very careful. Your friend, Dr. Cosby, you know, and he just said some stuff that people won't appreciate, that there has to be some kind of balance, something somewhere, to make sure that the victims are getting do justice, but at the same time, in the midst of these things, if they're found guilty, those who are being accused have some form of process to go through. That makes any sense to you?
It does. In LA, it's a difficult proposition just thinking about it, because as you were sort of recounting the process, we always have to remember Susan Smith and others who falsely accused black men of a crime.
Yeah.
This country is so willing and ready to believe that a black man has committed a crime without any evidence whatsoever. It's like their get out of jail card. And this could tend to be the same way. You utter the words and the institution, the political machine, comes down and destroys you. So there has to be some way of finding balance.
To your point, the young man who's black and gay who said he was assaulted, right, by two white men. Last name is escaping me. Pat Nation, help me, somebody. But yes, sir. On Empire, and he's not being believed, and I think he's not being believed more so that he's black than he's gay. I really believe that. You know, the Chicago police are like, well, show us the video. Show us this. Show us that. Where's your phone? Let me see your phone. And like he says he was attacked. Now, if he's lying, then again, you throw him under the bus. He's branded. But if he's telling the truth, why can't you believe him like any other non-African-American? And again, I just want to be careful and let people know I'm not saying victims aren't victims. All I'm saying is that we have to be, we probably got to be careful, Doc, and what we just say, okay, they're guilty, especially when it comes to people of color. That's what I'm saying.
Yes, we're predisposed to be accused of something. You know, it takes you back to the Emmett Till days.
Oh, my God.
He was accused. He was killed, and the young lady recanted. But this society is so quick to believe the negative when it comes to people of color. So
yep.
Lieutenant Governor Fairfax is caught up in this whirlwind
yep.
And again, it goes a long way. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're a victim of a sexual assault, you have to do the right thing. You have to step up. Don't hold it to later. That ruins your case. It ruins your possibility of being believed. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Doc. I got a text from someone that said, well, you know, what if that was your sister? Well, I have three sisters, by the way, caller. And I would never see it. This is the problem, Doc. This is what I'll bring Reggie in a second here. I let you go. This is the problem. Like, you can't speak out. I never said people don't listen. I'm not saying anything about the victims, you know, that are saying that, you know, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax committed his crimes. And even you said he could be a serial rapist or whatever the case may be, or offender, if you will. I'm not denying that. All I'm saying is that there's some double standards that take place with people of color, whether it be you and I getting accused of something, or, you know, a black female, you know, being accused of shoplifting or something, and it, they're automatically believing, well, she on, you know, she black, probably on welfare. There's those preconceived notions that go into stuff. That's all I'm saying. We have to be very careful, especially when it's us. And when it's us, we as us have to make sure that we have our checks and balances in place, Doc. That's all I'm saying, is that we have to be careful, because they're already ready. They already got us into a certain mode, right? And then when these things happen, this young man, that I'm getting a text just saying that they're trying to say that the actor, two men came forward and said that he paid them to attack him, that he knew the brothers and all this other stuff. You know, so all that stuff seems to happen. Emmett Till got, put through like he was a sausage going through a grinder. His mom couldn't even recognize his face if she didn't know it was Emmett Till. And then the white woman go, oh, by the way, he ain't really do it. You see what I'm saying? I mean, we have to be careful.
It's too late at that point. And L.A., let me speak on the Jesse Smollett case. Two things stand out to me in this case. Number one, you're talking about the Chicago police. And number two, these two African men think they speak with a dialect.
Right.
So are they truly the ones who accosted the actor? And the authorities just happened to meet them as they were departing a plane from Nigeria. How'd they know they were in Nigeria?
Right.
The Chicago Police Department has a whole lot of baggage. I don't know if I trust very much of what they say, or that they're the way that they're trying to slant this investigation.
And as I go to Reggie, I go to Reggie Howell. And Reggie, good evening to you. But there's two things that what Dr. Bell just said that are troubling to me. Number one, the Chicago police. I was talking with actually Chief Humphrey and some other people, and they have a history of cover-up and stuff. Look at their mayor, who is just a joke. But the other part of it is, they happen to get these two African brothers that, as Dr. Bell said, doesn't speak great English. The dialect is different. Maybe they're covering up for some other people that don't look like us. And then the second part of it is, I really believe, this is my opinion, L.A. Bachelor, that if this thing happens, they want to spin it on a attack on a gay person rather on a black person. I really believe that. They don't want it to be racist. They want it to be, you know, a gay bashing, if you will. They want it to be about that, more so about an attack on a black man. And he's both, right? But I think they want to separate it. You know, those are the case. And by the way, like I said to you, Doc, and Reggie, I'm saying if, right? So I'm even in this is an alleged incident. I'm never trying to brand anybody. The facts will come out, things will come out, and then we make our decisions from there. But they already got this guy, the public opinion of those who don't like him, black folks that I know, black women and men that don't like Empire, so they got their own preconceived notion. Oh, he on Empire, you know, whatever. I mean, just stupid stuff. Like, get over yourself. And let's be real about it. All right, go ahead, Reg. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. Dr. Bell, how you doing, sir?
I'm good, Reg. What about yourself?
I can't complain. I know time is short, so I'm not going to take too much time, but
you're good.
Believe No, I was just saying, I really truly believe that too much information is coming out where it needs to be a gag order put on this case. Chicago has already been incompetent when it comes to people of color and them trying to be fair. Thank God they have a new attorney general there. As a matter of fact, is trying to oversee the case right now where the judge only gave this alcohol terrorist that killed the young man running down the street, I think only 2 or 3 years, when the statute called for between 18, 20, and 30 years. So we could disconnect right there. Yeah, so I'm just saying, right. My humble opinion, they need to put a gag order on this. The thing is, though, you had individuals go into a factory, gun down people, and that's the story of people following locally, but the national media keeps following the story about the Empire Star. So that tells you what's driving this machine right now. They want to do everything they can to make sure that when somebody can say about that white supremacist hat, that mega hat, and in my opinion, it's the new racist hood. And I hope the emails do come out. Hell, you can send them to me. I'm saying right now, my humble opinion, that when the facts come out, we deal with it then. That's all I'm saying. That's the facts come out, and then you see how things go there.
Oh, I concur with you, Reg. Something does not smell good about this case. And, you know, it's ironic that the official was talking about a grand jury already, but the officer who shot Laquan McDonald 16, 17, 18 times, and then his brother fellow officers covered up for him and then got off with it. Now, I want to preface this by saying this. I'm not against law enforcement. My brother has a career in law enforcement. Chief Humphreys, to the utmost. But there's some bad seeds out there. And historically, we can count them.
Yeah.
So just look at the case for how it's being handled and all of that. And you know, it's interesting. I was watching a CNN show today, and I heard something that just amazed me. They were talking about the two little white girls who was killed 2 years ago in Ohio. The perpetrator or perpetrators have not yet been caught. One of the victims took a photo and the video recording of a man on the trail with him. They have the guy's voice. They have his likeness, even though it's grainy. The law reporter said there is no mechanism in place right now to recognize faces from a picture. There's no way you can just put a picture in and somebody's picture comes up and it tells you. Now, I've been told we have this facial recognition stuff.
Right.
But today, on CNN, a legal analyst said they don't have anything that is foolproof right now.
Let me ask this real quick to Reggie, why you are, because you're there in the Capitol in Virginia, right? So there's a lot of dialogue and conversations and things that are going on, Reggie, and
mm-hmm.
your Commonwealth. You had a Democrat, a white Democrat, that wanted to impeach this lieutenant governor. And yet nobody said anything about Northam. Now, I asked you, full disclosure, Reggie, when all this came down, I texted you back and we texted back and forth when it all came down, and you had told me some stuff and thought it had some speculations and things, and you can disclose that if you want. But the point is that when you look at it now, where everything is now, and like I said, I'm getting somebody text me and say, well, you know, what if it was your sister and all this stuff. You know, and nobody's trying to, you know, belittle any female that has been raped or assaulted or forced to do anything out of their will. But what are you hearing? And from what, when it came out and I text you, like, Reggie, should he step down? And back then and to now, where are you on those three particular people in terms of should they step down, should they stay?
Well, as far as the governor and general, in my opinion, both should step down. I feel like the lieutenant governor, there is a due process in place where the FBI can come in, just like the Judge Kavanaugh situation. But politically, I've talked to some activists and also some people with the NAACP and others. This is how they're looking at it. From the political point of view, they rather keep the Democrats in power rather than put the Republican in power. I'm just being honest with you, bro. I'm telling you, behind the scenes, look, you've seen the article already where the ministers came out hat in hand and said we need to forgive them and everything. But if this had been a Jewish community, if this had been a Chinese community, their heads would have been on the platter. They'd have been on the next thing smoking. But then again, you know, when we don't respect ourselves, then this is what happened. I mean, just a follow-up to your question earlier, Jason, I know the attorney, I'm lieutenant governor personally, you know, from my days at the radio station, so I want to make that full disclosure. I truly believe, in my humble opinion, that victim number two that came out that was at Duke University has already been caught in a lie where she told another person, the basketball player, allegedly, that I'm going to make your life hell by the way he put a restraining order on her. And there's been text messages coming out.
Why is that not out there, though? Why is that not out there, Reggie? Why is that not?
It's out there. It's out there. It's out there. Like I said, you can even Google her name and talk about a restraining order and false information she has given. She's already said that she made the basketball player, I'm going to make your life a living hell, and I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to have fun destroying you like you're trying to destroy me. So it's already out there. So already it's a cloud over her head. As far as victim number one, I would say this, that a scorned woman, and your emailer can get upset all he wants. The bottom line, nobody on this show has said anything about diminishing rape when it comes to a woman. All this is the white supremacists and the right-wing extremists trying to, should we say, muddy the waters. You have said that over and over again. So, email, come on, grow up and be intellectually honest. Stop being intellectually dishonest. Nobody has diminished anything.
Yeah, I'm thinking. I'm thinking it's a female, but go ahead.
I don't care if it's a female. I'm saying, come on. Because if we want to go from the historical point of view, I can go to the Black Wall Street where an alleged woman claimed a man just brushed up against her and thousands of black people were killed over a lie. I can go down to Florida where we had Rosewood where they're trying to wipe it off the damn match. Why? Because a white woman claimed a black man raped her. So come on. Just be intellectually honest about this. Just not play these silly-ass games. Let the facts come out. If the lieutenant governor is proven to rape these people, then he will go to jail. There's no statute of limitations.
Yeah.
But the man needs to have a fair process. That's all we're saying. Do fair process.
And Doc, you get the final word on this because go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Reg. Finish up. I'm sorry. My bad.
No, that's not me.
It needs to go through due process. That's the law. And that's one of the
But,
Doc,
let me ask you, though, the concern, I guess the concern I have, or what Reggie said, Reggie's right there. He's in Richmond. So he's right there. And so if activists, right, and that's what you are, activists and whatever organization activists falls under in this particular case are saying, well, you know, I get it, but we want to keep some Democrats in place and all of that. What does that say to you when you are, you know, going through the water crisis, right? Like, ain't nobody talking about keeping certain people in place in the water crisis, and you got to deal with people getting sick and possibly dying and legionnaires and everything else. But in this case, they want to keep people. I don't agree with it. I've been on the record, and I'll say that all day, every day. I don't care if he's a Democrat and the greatest Democrat for black people in the minute. The blackface and Klansmen is terrorizing. He got to go. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. So activists and people go, and I've had, like I said, I've had people on this show that said, hey, well, for the good of the party and the good for black people, no, it's not the good of the party and good for black people, because he doesn't get it. He wants to fall on his whiteness and go, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, let's keep it moving. No, we don't do that. You made a mistake because that's how you feel in your heart. I don't care if it was 20 years ago, whatever, and you don't seem to get it. You're talking about endangered servants and not slavery. You don't even get it. And you in the interview, you still don't get it. No, you got to go, Doc. And so when you hear activists, people saying, black activists saying what Reggie is hearing, how does that make you feel? Is there any adjustments or compromises in that point?
It's not a good thing, L.A., because all it tells me is that the policies that are to follow, the policies that these individuals would put in place, would not be in my best interest. If they compromise to keep their political careers, what else will they compromise for? What will
That's
they
right.
sell their soul for? You gotta go, gotta
yep.
go.
And it's just got to be that way. You know, and I'm in a straight redneck state, and some people might get mad at me for saying that in North Carolina, you know, but, you know, and that was the case to hear, I'd be saying the same thing, you know. These commonwealths, respectfully to Reggie, but, you know, Reggie and I had this conversation before, you know, there's some issues there, man, and I can't get down with that. I can't, Doc. I just don't think that this man should stay. And like I said, and people, I'm getting emails and stuff, and that's okay. That's all right. But, you know, people, I'm not advocating the, you know, lieutenant governor to stay and be the governor. What I am saying is that it's the Rooney Rule. Let us get in there, and if we stink up the joint, fire us. But it's got to be a fair and balanced thing. So fire all three of them. Just get rid of all three, and then you got no problems. You can't pick and choose. Just get rid of all three of them, if that's the case.
And,
Doc?
And L.A., by holding up that standard.
Right.
It puts people on notice. But you got to keep your nose clean. Character is
right.
what you are, what you do when nobody else is looking.
That's
we
right.
We have to have charactered public service. When we don't,
and if he,
hold people, when we don't hold people to that standard, we get somebody like that guy that's residing in the White House.
Yeah, that idiot. And that's what his own so-called supporter called him that, so I can feel comfortable even say it now. Ann Coulter called him an idiot. He is an idiot, but we've been saying he's an idiot anyway, and a racist and a narcissist and all that other stuff. But, yeah. And by the way, he grabbed people by the private parts, women by the private parts, and got 22 that I think, maybe 25, if I'm not mistaken, counts of sexual assault. And he's the president of these United States, right? And he's serving and fine and everything, all is well in the world. And this gentleman, I think that it seems like he might have done some stuff. It looks like it. We don't know. Those two counts enough should put him in jail. And if the, if those two counts are true, then he should be in jail, right? And that's Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, and that's what it's supposed to be. We, that's the thing too, Doc. It's like they don't think we're being fair, but we're actually being fair. They're the ones that are unfair. Like we're like, okay, he's guilty, throw him under the bus, and you know. OJ might have did it, you know what I mean? Did it or whatever. We're very fair in what we say and do. They're the ones that play and look for corners to cut to protect their own. And I know I'm going to get in trouble with that, and that's okay. Here's what it is.
And but let's remember, LA, the governor kept the lieutenant governor's picture off of some campaign literature.
Right.
Because it was requested by the union. So we already know he has a propensity to sell his soul.
And he didn't know about his yearbook, but he can dress up like Michael Jackson and in the same year. But he forgot the other one. No, I don't think so. I was born at night, but not last night. So you need to take your little tail and sit down and go do race relations on your own time, not on taxpayers' times. That's really what it is. If anybody, ironically, that might want to make a case for staying, and that's not getting that publicity, I think they're all, you know, eventually if it's all playing that way, should go. But if anybody has a better leg to stand on from the governor is the attorney general. Who said, you know what, dang, man, I messed up and did that and whatever and trying to go through his little tour. Not to say he's right. I'm just saying he go on this tour and say I was wrong and this is what I did. So the other two we'll see. Doc, before you go, because I know how important the water crisis is to your folk, give us an update because I know I get updates from you. But the latest update of what's happening, in particular now, Doc, that it, at the very least in the House of Congress and in the representatives, there is a Democratic stronghold. So are there some subpoenas and some things that are going to be clear in what took place and is taking place with this genocide?
Representative Cummings has alluded to he would do some hearings because he believes then Governor Snyder lied before the committee, the oversight committee. What worries me, he gave the outgoing governor till January 11th to produce all of his communications. And we haven't heard anything about those communications, whether they were turned over or not. I believe that the committee, oversight committee, they're probably busy right now looking at 45, but we were promised that there would be action. So on that front, the jury is still out. The governor, Whitmer, the new governor, she tried to reorganize the Michigan Department of Quality, MDEQ, and the Republican legislature has blocked her from doing that. One of her campaign commitments and one of her first moves while in office is to ensure safe drinking water and the protection of our Great Lakes. But working with the opposition, it's going to be tough probably.
How can people reach out to you and get involved?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Dr. Lee Bell. I just put my face back on LinkedIn at Dr. Lee Bell also. So those are the two best ways. My email is drleebell@hotmail.com, drleebell@hotmail.com.
Well, Doc, I certainly appreciate you, man, as always. Keep doing what you're doing. We just thank you for your efforts.
Well, thank you for your support, you and Reggie's both, and congratulations on the continued building of the network.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Doc. We really appreciate you, sir.
Thank you, L.A.
Yep. Dr. Lee Bell, of course, a motivational speaker, media personality, and, of course, a community activist on a pad. Take a break, come back, and get to Christopher Brook on the pad.
Hey there, this is L.A. Bachelor, host of the Bachelor Pad show from the Bachelor Pad Network, inviting you to tune in on Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, for the Donaldson File with your hosts Tom Donaldson and Coco Cosney. They bring politics and other perspectives from the left and from the right. The Donaldson Files every Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Bachelor Pad Radio Network.
And welcome back to the Bachelor Pad on the Bachelor Pad Radio Network, blogtalkradio.com, WCOMFM.org, of course, WCOM in the good city of Chapel Hill, Carrboro area. L.A. Bachelor, hope you're having a good one thus far. I want to bring in my guest, of course, always good to have him on. He is from the North Carolina chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. He is Christopher Brook, and Christopher, always good to have you on, sir.
Always good to be on. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I had you on. I have you on today because there's been a lot of controversy, well, made up by number 45 at the White House, as it relates to building a wall. Now, there were two shutdowns that happened, and the stickler or the problem issue between, say, Democrats and this president was funding for a wall. He wanted $5 million, and they wanted of giving them 1.3 something or other for building more security, if you will, sort of a fence or gate and some more funding in terms of having more security personnel and those type of things there. But the president, as rumored and as expected, it wasn't good enough for him, so he has declared a national emergency to free up more funds to build the wall without the congressional approval. Now, I want you to clear it up as best as you know, since you guys are suing, and we'll get back to that from the ACLU standpoint, but this National Emergencies Act of 1975, we've had presidents, which I'll name some, that have made that declaration, but Congress, A, has the purse. They have the power to purse. So can you explain what is constitutionally right when it comes to national emergencies and this act that was passed back in 1975?
Yeah, and I mean, so the statute in question gives the president the right to declare a national emergency. So there's a statutory component to this. There's also a constitutional component to this of checks and balances, where the boiling things down and simplifying things a great deal, the president executes the laws, and the legislature passes the laws, including controlling the power of the purse. So, you know, there are a couple of questions. I mean, there's first a statutory question about whether this constitutes a national emergency, and then there's the related question about whether this falls within the president's constitutional power and authority. You know, obviously, there's a component where defining a national emergency is sort of in the eye of the beholder. Obviously, the president has made something of an argument that this constitutes a national emergency. I don't think that that withstands very much scrutiny at all. Both because it looks very different than the national emergencies that have been declared by previous presidents, but also because, you know, of the facts of this particular circumstance. You know, the past invocations of national emergencies have been commonly agreed upon by across party aisles and in response to real calamities, you know, 9/11. Being the sort of quintessential example of a national emergency. No one was doubting that that was a national emergency, and it was a national emergency that came about due to the action, you know, outside actors, terrorists who had attacked our country. This national emergency is declared only after there is a long political debate, including a government shutdown, around this particular issue, Democrats sort of uniformly don't want to fund a border wall. There are a lot of Republicans who don't want to fund a border wall, don't believe this is an emergency. So the president, only after he does not get what he wants out of a political debate, declares a national emergency. That not only looks very different than the national emergencies that have been declared in the past, but also it looks like it's something of the president's own making by so emphasizing this border wall, you know, not declaring an emergency at the outset, but only at the end of this political debate. He's, you know, obviously ratcheted up the pressure on people seeking asylum and seeking refuge via our southern border. So, you know, this is obviously going to be headed for the courts. It's a little bit in the eye of the beholder, but I think the very least you can agree that this looks very different than previously declared national emergencies.
I'm talking with Christopher Brook, of course, from the ACLU here on the pad. Let me ask you this. Is it in the eye of the beholder, as you mentioned early in your statement? I want to read a couple of things to you. The President of the United States has available certain powers that you mentioned that may be exercised in the event that the nation is threatened by crisis or emergency circumstances other than, they say, natural disasters, war, or near-war situations, but 9/11 happened. Such powers may be stated explicitly or implied by the Constitution, assumed by the chief executive to be permissible constitutionally, or inferred from or specified by the statute. Through legislation, Congress has made a great many delegations of authority in the regard over the past 200 years. Jimmy Carter, this act started in 75. According to the Brennan Center, it's been 58 national emergencies called by the presidents since then. Jimmy Carter, back in 1979, of course, with the in response to the Iran-Contra hostage crisis, there they froze assets. I think that's still in effect with some frozen assets with Iran. President Reagan did it six times. President George H.W. Bush did it in August, September, November, October of 91, and May of 92. Bill Clinton did it a bunch of times, and I'm not going into all of those. And the previous presidents there, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and particularly with the influenza pandemic that was never terminated or continued, so still in effect per se. So I mentioned these because, you know, it seems like it's a lot of scrutiny based on certain beliefs of the president, and then Congress has to get on board with those the monies to fund this. But when you look at the situation, is it primarily or more specifically when it's in the national interest, when we're threatened by influenza, by another country, by illegal immigrants? Is he making a case from that standpoint? Is that somewhat legit?
Well, I don't think so. And I think, you know, obviously his argument would be that we have a crisis at the border that constitutes a national emergency. And he, you know, speaks about it in two different ways. He speaks about it as a crisis in regards to the threats that folks coming to the country via the southern border pose to folks already in our country, but he also poses it as a humanitarian crisis and therefore tries to sort of shoehorn it into the national emergency definition. Let me just suggest that there are two things that are different about this national emergency than previously declared national emergencies. The first one is that he is acting pretty much directly in contravention to the legislative action that just took place. We had a government shutdown. We had months of disagreement, even when Republicans controlled both the House and the Senate, about needing to build a border wall. So at the end of that process, and essentially in opposition and as a result of the fact that he could not get from the legislature what he wanted, he declares a national emergency. That is very different than the other circumstances where if there was legislative action, it served to sort of affirm or ratify or at least be in concert and pushing in the same direction as what the executive sought to do. This is an instance where the legislature has moved in the exact opposite direction, and essentially the president is essentially trying to make an end run around them. I think that's pretty unique. And we're on pretty slippery ground there. The second thing that I would suggest that's a little bit different is that this is an instance where some of the basis, if not the majority of the basis, for where we're at this present moment is the president's own actions. His exceptionally harsh treatment of people at the border, you know, trying to prevent them from seeking asylum outside of ports of entry, in our perspective, in contravention to the law, is, again, in what we believe is contravention of the law, you know, forcing asylum seekers to remain in Mexico, the family separation policy. You know, from our perspective, none of these have served to make anyone any safer, and in fact have imperiled refugees who are seeking asylum here in the United States. But they very much, very clearly ratcheted up the humanitarian crisis that's happening at the border. So I would just suggest that it's pretty perilous ground for a president to play a large role in creating a national emergency, not get his proposed solution from the legislature to the national emergency that he's contributed to, and then be able to declare a national emergency in contravention to what the legislature has done. At that point, you know, what is the legislature doing, and how much power are we vesting in our executive? I think that pondering those questions leads to some pretty unsettling answers.
Just as a note, this president has invoked this three times. December 20th of last year, blocking the property of persons involved in serious human rights abuse or corruption. September 12th, I should say that was 2017. September 12, 2018, imposing certain sanctions in the event of foreign interference in a United States election, which he was sort of forced to do, namely Russia. And then November 27th of 2017, blocking property of certain persons contributing to the situation in Nicaragua. I will say, and I'll ask you this, Chris, a lot of us, myself included, and you sort of alluded to it, but is this policy, is this act that he's trying to impose racist?
I think that viewed in the broadest context here, the answer is yes. You have to start when you answer that question with him coming down the escalator in Trump Tower when he declared he was running for president and spoke of folks who were coming to our country via Mexico, via Central America, from Central America and Mexico, as being rapists and murderers. He has continued along those lines, you know, up to and including at his State of the Union address just earlier this month, in his comments at the Rose Garden. You know, first off, vastly overstating the challenges associated with illegal immigration, which is at a very low level from a historical perspective, but also vastly misstating the dangers posed by folks coming to this country. As study after study has shown, that they that immigrants to this country are more law-abiding than U.S. citizens. And, you know, you have to also put it in the context of his, you know, negative comments about African countries in recent years and about immigration from African countries. You have to put it in the context of the travel ban, very much focused on Islamic visitors to our country. I think at a certain point, you're sort of willfully blind if you're saying that race is not playing a factor here. And, you know, the way that he has spoken about immigrants to our country, in particular immigrants from across the southern border, oftentimes is overtly racist. And I think you got to call a spade after a certain point.
Talking with Christopher Brook, definitely appreciate him coming on. He's the legal director at the ACLU of North Carolina. And to your point, Chris, not only immigrants less likely to commit crimes, in particular violent crimes, and not only, as you mentioned, you know, illegal immigration's down over the last five decades, really. The point of interest, when Trump talks about, you know, drugs coming in all over different borders and stuff where they don't have this quote-unquote wall, that's not right. It's an out-and-out lie, because most of the drugs come in direct point checkpoints when people come into this country from Mexico in particular. So, again, not factually true. I call it lie. People like to say not factually true. No, he's lying. He's deliberately lying because he wants to do the scare and fear tactics to get his wall. So why the ACLU? First point, because you guys have, as soon as he declared, I mean, I heard, getting releases from the ACLU, like, we are filing a lawsuit. What is the ACLU looking at to file this lawsuit first and foremost?
Well, first and foremost, we're looking at the fact of what we've just been talking about, which is that this is just the latest step in his anti-immigrant from our standpoint, racially motivated campaign against folks who are seeking refuge in our country. So that is what is first and foremost animating us. But also, to the points that I was making previously, you know, we've been we safeguard the constitutional rights of everybody in our country, but we also safeguard the constitutional system that has served us so well as a country, and that really is sort of the hope for the future in solving the persistent problems that we have. And central to that is a system of separation and checks and balances, where the executive doesn't get what they want. They're not allowed to make an end run around the legislature, where the executive is not able to put pieces in place that will inevitably result in an emergency and then declare an emergency to essentially provide himself or herself with more authority. And, you know, one of the things that I think the reason we were able to sue so quickly is because the president telegraphed that this was the direction he was heading in for quite some time. One of the things that was also very interesting to me and exciting to me was, you know, we're suing with the Sierra Club. You know, an environmental group, and you might say, you know, what is the Sierra Club doing with ACLU and vice versa? Well, you know, one of the things that about this wall that is so ridiculous is, you know, this is going to wreak great environmental damage over some very pristine but also important areas of our country. You know, what are we going to be doing? Building a wall in the middle of the Rio Grande? Building a wall in the middle of the desert? You know, that's going to harm the environment as well. It's also going to harm private landowners, because most of the land that separates the United States from Mexico is privately held at this point.
I was going to say that.
I think that sort of just underlines the reality is this should not be a left-right issue. This should, you know, there are a lot of reasons to be angry about this. There's a civil liberty and civil rights reason.
To that point, too, that you have conservatives that are saying – ACLU, why not let Congress sue? Why, you know, California's already jumped in the fold. They've already filed it. Why the ACLU? It to their point, I don't agree, but to their point, it makes it seem partisan. And I even have some people that are conservatives to say, how many times has the ACLU sued presidents who tried to enact this act of 1975?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came up during the course of the travel ban conversation is that, you know, we found a lot of these sort of emergency immigration actions, whether they, you know, there was one that was taken by President Carter and by President Reagan, that, you know, we told courts that we felt were constitutionally problematic. You know, I mean, I certainly understand that we've been suing the president a great deal. But, I mean, you know, I think that actually we, along with the Sierra Club, add a particularly nonpartisan tilt to it because, you know, the Democratic Attorney General of California suing the president is all well and good. I think perhaps the House of Representatives will sue the president, led by Speaker Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker. You know, I think in those instances, it could just be viewed as a Democrats versus Republicans thing. We hope to bring, you know, both the civil liberties, civil rights, environmental, and property rights arguments to bear as well. I'm not naive enough to ignore the fact that some people, you know, view us as something like partisan actors as well. I understand that, but I do think that we add something that those attorney generals and the House are not going to be able to add to the mix here.
Yeah, great point. And it doesn't make any – you're spot on. It makes no practical sense unless eminent domain is going to take place. I mean, there's so many private owners that own that land. It's a complete mess, not just from a legality and constitutional standpoint, but it's a mess from a lot of other different reasons, and I'm very familiar with Sierra Club, and I know they're very concerned with this. Talking with Christopher Brook. Chris, before we get out of here, a few more questions. What steps are, now that the ACLU has filed this lawsuit against the president, what are the steps now, what happens now from your standpoint?
Well, you know, I think that the litigation will move forward. I am not entirely clear on exactly how we're going to proceed here. A lot of these cases have proceeded with our side seeking what's called a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order, which would allow us, based on the facts as we understand them now, to very quickly seek relief and would seek to block any action from going forward while these cases percolate in the legal system. So, you know, and in some instances, there have been nationwide injunctions sought that essentially would prevent any action from taking place across the nation corresponding and in furtherance of the president's national emergency. Obviously, the border, if memory serves, I believe would include at least three judicial circuits. It obviously includes the Ninth Circuit, it includes the Fifth Circuit, it includes, if memory serves, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. So getting an injunction from the Ninth Circuit, for example, would only potentially resolve or prohibit activity in California and Arizona along the border. So you really do need to have some nationwide relief here to be able to get the scope of the relief that you would need for it to be complete. We'll see how things proceed, but I imagine that these matters will move. We'll try to move quickly, just basically to meet the challenge fully that has been laid down here by the president.
If you know, Congress, you know, as you said, Speaker Pelosi, you know, alluded to, you know, filing a lawsuit. And you mentioned some Republicans have concerns about this, but concerns and, you know, voting on this and voting your conscience and voting on the record in the Senate, because Congress, obviously, the House, they, you know, the Dems have the power, so they can, if they want to, you know, have a resolution, you know, to stop this and file a lawsuit, they're in control, but the Senate is obviously different. So you think that the Senate will get on board? Do you think that some of these cowards will actually stop with the rhetoric and the, quote, grave concern about what the president is doing and actually stand up against this president in a vote?
Well, you know, we will see. Your guess is as good as mine here. I'll simply say a couple of things. First, I'll say that the one place where the president has won time and time and time again is in his opinion and his view of conservatism prevailing over Republican orthodoxy. Time and again, he has bent the Republican establishment to his will. If that doesn't happen here in the Senate, this would be really one of the few, if not the first time, that it was not happening here. Second, I think perhaps you already see some signs that that's the direction that we're going, that the House will pass a resolution disapproving of the president's action, and then it will languish, if not fail, in the Senate. And I think that the first piece of evidence in regards to that was Senate Leader McConnell flip-flopping on this issue. You know, obviously been well reported that he had been warning the president against this step when it became plain that the president, it seemed like the only way the president was going to sign the bill to keep the government open and avoid another partial government shutdown, was declaring a national emergency. The Senate leader McConnell obviously went to the Senate floor and said, you know, that he supported the declaration of a national emergency. So I think, you know, unfortunately, that's probably some sort of forecast of what is to tell. And, you know, I think that relatedly to all those things, most of the people who are Republicans in the Senate, and there are obviously some exceptions to this, fear a primary challenge more than they do losing to a Democrat. You know, if you're a Republican in the Senate from Wyoming and Idaho and the North Dakota, South Dakota, the list goes on, but really a lot of the states, you know, North Carolina maybe is even on that list. You're just as fearful, if not more fearful, of being challenged by a Trump supporter and somebody who sort of pledges fealty to Trump as you are of a Democrat calling you to task. There are obviously some exceptions to that. You know, Cory Gardner in Colorado, for example, comes to mind. That's very sort of a trending blue state. It'll be interesting to see how he handles the situation. Rand Paul, sort of a libertarian Republican, at least on occasions, from Kentucky. It'll be interesting to see how he handles the situation. But, yeah, no, I mean, I think you'd be a little bit naive to be optimistic about how this is going to work out and in regards to Congress playing their, the Senate in particular, playing their role here based on the way things have gone over the course of the last couple of years.
It's been sort of a trend, too, both Republican and Democrats in the House and the Senate, that they've been, over the years, whatever president, just giving more and more and more power to the executive office. And it's
exactly
troubling.
Right. Exactly.
It's
right.
Troubling to me. And I think that's why people don't understand the ACLU, because you might trend a certain way when it comes to human rights and equal rights, because they tend to affect brown and black people. But constitutionally, you've been fighting because the powers of the presidency, that office, has been growing and growing. And I think it needs to stop. Incidentally, you mentioned we call him Mr. Magoo, Mitch McConnell, and you know he's not even popular in his own state. And there were some things that were put in place to help kids in Kentucky that will be affected. I'm not going to go into all the details. That he will have some as. You know, Ricky Ricardo would say, have some splaining to do to his people, because it's gonna hurt them, and he should be worried about, you know, getting through a primary to get reelected, let alone get reelected. Finally, sort of a multi question: will he ultimately get the funds he seeks? If so, how soon will you think it will happen? You said that, you know, the ACLU probably puts injunctions in place to try to stop it. Or do you think he loses? And if it goes to where we think it's going, which would be the highest court of the land, and the Supreme Court, with him putting Judge Kavanaugh there, do you think that will be sort of that feather in the cap that he's banking on to rule in his favor?
Yeah, I think that's the $64,000 question, right? I mean, I think that the way these things have played out in the past is that they've been enjoined by lower courts, and then the Supreme Court has reversed on a narrow ideological based on a narrow margin 5-4 decision on ideological grounds. That's how the travel ban litigation moved forward. You know, I think it's quite likely that the president's action here will be enjoined at the trial court level and perhaps at the circuit court of appeals level. I think it's quite likely that this matter will, as you've suggested, end up in front of the United States Supreme Court again. And, you know, at that point, I think it becomes difficult to predict how this is going to go down. But I think you can say a few things with certainty. I think the four, quote-unquote, liberal members of the court are unlikely to be swayed that this is a national emergency based for the reasons that we've discussed during the course of this talk. I think that there is nothing in Justice Thomas's and Justice Alito's record that suggests that they would be willing to place a brake on the president's actions. There's always a first time for everything, but they have expansive views of executive authority. Justice Gorsuch has not been on the bench as long, but he seems to have an expansive view of executive authority as well. I think that's also the case of at least Justice Kavanaugh as he's been on when he's been on the lower court. I think that there, you know, I think perhaps, you know, we don't know enough about what Justice Kavanaugh will do because he's so new to the court. Maybe Justice Gorsuch could surprise us here. But I think that there's a very good chance that this will end up being decided by the Chief Justice again, that he is he's now the sort of center of the court on every different level. And, you know, there are two different ways of viewing this. One, you can view it through the lens of the travel ban, where he deferred to the president on exceptionally flimsy grounds and basically set aside the president's statements regarding why a travel ban was necessary and the sort of animus-laden statements that he had made previously. If that is going to be the approach in this circumstance, then it could well be a 5-4 decision again upholding the president's ability to declare a national emergency. On the other hand, and you've seen Chief Justice Roberts plainly uncomfortable with the president talking down the judiciary, talking about Obama judges and Clinton judges and talking down so-called judges in the Ninth Circuit. So I think the president, the Chief Justice is a smart man. He understands that there is something unique about the current president. And perhaps that frame will help to inform how he views this circumstance. But I think anybody who tells you that this is a slam dunk in front of the Supreme Court, that President Trump's actions will be prohibited by and declared unconstitutional or violating from the statute, I think is probably getting a little bit ahead of themselves.
And just let me make a comment that the highest courts, first of all, they talk about the Ninth Circuit being so liberal, but their lower courts are very conservative in Texas and other places, right? So that's blown out of the water. But I compare the Supreme Court to the Senate because the balance of power is in a conservative place. And that's a concern. I also feel like when liberals and Democrats got all excited when, you know, Democrats won the House of Representatives, that they were all excited, but the Senate still is in a conservative power. And this leader, Mitch McConnell, has sided with this president in a lot of ways. He's been a coward. This is my words, not yours. And so that's the concern. And if it goes there, I just see, I don't know about this Chief Justice. You're right. It can go any way. But at the end of the day, a final quick question for you. From a progressive Democrat ACLU standpoint, as it relates to this particular case, can they prolong it? And I hate to say it because it's taxpayers and everything. Can they prolong it until 2020 and maybe he loses and then the next president is a Democrat and they just squash all of this? Is that a scenario?
Yeah, certainly that's a possibility, is that this case gets drug out so long he's ultimately blocked from getting the money that he would need for wall construction until a new president has the opportunity to take office. I will say that there's obviously a flip side, though, to sort of seeking to block him right now, is that there'd be a preliminary injunction entered, right? And that can be appealed by the government. And the government has indicated many times not only that they will appeal those sorts of injunctions, but they'll also seek to, and on some occasions have succeeded in jumping over the federal courts of appeals and going straight to the Supreme Court. It's a little bit of a different matter because it's really time sensitive. But the census dispute is going straight from a federal trial court to the United States Supreme Court. That's a big leap. The other thing that bears mentioning here is that, it only takes four votes, not five votes, four votes in the United States Supreme Court to hear these cases. So it doesn't even necessarily require Chief Justice Roberts' vote to hear this case. So it could just be that Thomas, Gorsuch, Alito, and Kavanaugh want to hear this case. I think that obviously very early in this process, but it's entirely possible that this case could be fully litigated and decided by the United States Supreme Court by June of 2020, a little bit more than a year from now, at the end of their next term. We shall see.
Wow. And for those who say, you're dragging it out, I seem to recall Mitch McConnell not even wanting to have a vote on the floor for the previous president to put someone on the highest court of the land till after the elections, which Donald Trump won, allegedly, and of course, he put in two of his judges there. Chris, I don't normally do this, but because we didn't get a chance to get to some folks on the phone, but if there's an email, people can reach out and ask questions, because it's a very complicated yet very important discussion to have. Can they reach you, or should they just send emails to me and then I can send those questions to you?
The best way if folks have questions or need legal assistance is to email us, and they can do so at contact@aclufnc.org. So that's contact@aclufnc.org.
Christopher, always good, man. You're always insightful, and you're always there when I need you, and I appreciate the time, sir.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's always good to talk.
Thank you. We're going to take a break and come back and get back on the pad, 646-929-0130. It's the Bachelor Pad. Stay tuned.